Thank you. An awful lot of comments, so I'm going to try not to repeat anything, but I do commend the board. I think it's appropriate to, with the importance of the auditor's relationship with the audit committee, that there be a clear description of what the expectations are of the auditor in those communications. And having building blocks, those things that are essential requirements that we all would concede should be communicated, is an appropriate approach. And I think the listing of items is not that long or that complicated that it would cause me a particular concern. I suspect that a lot of that, because it's there, ends up being check the box, and also from my perspective, that's not all that bad if the box is checked properly and the work has been done and there's an element of professionalism that the auditor brought to the work and says to the audit committee, we've looked at these areas, these are the ones you don't need to work on. Now let us talk about those things that are really, we think you need to put your focus on, those things that are critical to you. The tone at the top you've talked about, I tend to get at that another way with auditors. I always ask them, do your staff like to be on this job? Is this a job within the office that people are competitively trying to be the auditor of, or is it one where you're reluctantly dragging people to the table? And that usually prompts either the issues that are really there and underlying what needs to be dealt with in relationships with management, or it's a confirmation that you actually do have the best team. The element of no surprises is certainly what I look for in an audit relationship. Mary Hartman and Morris just mentioned that. I think it's fully appropriate from both sides. I don't want to surprise the auditor. I don't think the auditor ought to be surprising us. And the auditor ought to expect that if there's an article in a newspaper about an industry similar to the one that I'm the audit committee chair of that identifies a problem somewhere within that industry or components of that industry, that I'd want to talk about, do we have that concern here? Is it something that we ought to be looking at? Are those issues that should be raised? And also, where there are restatements and the audit firm is involved in those restatements, are there any indications that that there are problems that could also migrate to our account? And in a sense, what I like to do in that way is to test the professionalism and the communication skills of the auditor. The concept that is in here of two-way communication, I agree with. I think it's sound. I'm not sure it fits all that neatly within a document that's for the auditors. And so there's probably other ways that you could describe it. For instance, you could describe to the auditor in the standard what to do if the audit committee is not communicating with them. And I think they're the same three or four different things that you've described here. And I think they would be signals, red flags that you have a problem. But I think it may be difficult to try and put in an audit committee responsibility chart or checklist in the form of a standard written for the auditors themselves. I think you can imply certain things out of that. I think you can cause action to occur. I also think, notwithstanding what some to think is a lack of guidance on best practices for audit committees, I think there's a ton of material out there. Almost every accounting firm, every consulting operation, endless numbers of conferences that address this issue of what audit committees ought to be paying attention to. And I think there are some very good practices in that. If there's a perceived need from the audit community that the audit committees are not living up to their expectations. That's maybe another problem, but it may be that it should be dealt with in a way apart from the communication to the auditor. So, again, I think this is good work. I think you've really drawn out a lot of things that do need to be addressed that are there that we all think about. Having guidance is absolutely essential. That's your role. And I think you've done a good job on what you've produced at this point.
Don, thanks for those comments. And some of the other topics that Don, you touched on, two-way communications and others, we will have further sessions today to explore some of those concepts more in depth. We have, I think, about four cards up right now on this particular topic still on the what are the right communications that audit committees want, and what are the communications that investors want committee members to have. So I think we have Denny Beresford, Bob Doerr, Kiko Harvey, and Hal Schroeder, and Arnie Hainish. Five cards. And then we'll take a break, if that's all right. So, Denny?
Thanks, Marty. A suggestion. If the PCAOB staff has not already done this, I'd suggest that you actually ask some accounting firms to show you the communications that they actually have with some audit committees, both for some larger corporations and some smaller corporations, well, some small accounting firms. As indicated in my earlier comments, my concern is that we just get overwhelmed as audit committee members, and particularly with written communications. I'm all for written communications, but the problem is, if you think about it, we get four letters of representations each year, most of which, frankly, could take almost the entire amount of time that we devote to audit committees. I'm exaggerating just a little bit, but those things get very long, very little has changed. Question is that a very effective use of our time as audit committee members to read all of those things? We get the annual engagement letter, where audit firms sometimes try to sneak in CYA-type paragraphs from time to time, Bob. not looking at you. You just happen to be the auditor for three of my four boards.
I can't imagine that.
But that's simply the law.
Again, a whole lot of boilerplate, very little changes from year to year. We get typically a quarterly listing of all of the, I think it's SAS 61 and 114, I believe it is, if I'm not mistaken, type requirements, much of which has not changed from quarter to quarter. It's usually exception-type reporting. Again, we read it all. We're not sure exactly what it is that we're supposed to be focusing on. Very little is being called to our attention. So the totality is that we have a lot of information to, quote, read, or at least we think we're supposed to read it all. But in the final analysis, there probably are maybe two or three little things buried in maybe, I mean, not exaggerating, maybe 50 or 60 pieces of paper that might be of importance to us. Now, hopefully, if we've done a good job with, as audit committee members and the engagement partner, audit committee chairs and engagement partners, we've had them focus. At least we've had them yellow in them or something like that, and that they've only talked to us at the meetings about the things that are important. But this is part of the problem. And this is part of the checklist mentality, that there's so many of these required things that just kind of bury the time for effective communication. So I really urge you to have the staff, if you haven't already done it, just look to see how this stuff plays out in practice now, and consider the fact that you're going to add to it another half dozen or eight or ten, I don't know what it is exactly, but how these things would just be more of the same, and just add to the fact that we just have this amount of paperwork that doesn't really communicate, doesn't really add to effective communications. It just is paper that's not necessarily working. And as I said, as we have several people have said already, all audit committees are not created effectively, or the same, I should say. And I'm convinced there are a lot of committees out there where the engagement partner just gets up and reads to the audit committee all of those detailed things from SAS 114 each quarter, and the poor audit committee members just sit there and take it. And that's it.
End of sermon. Thanks, Denny. A couple of things. One, your point is certainly a good one about getting out there and looking at things, and we have looked at audit committee reports, and in some cases many of us, or some of us here, have been involved in them in very large companies. And to some extent, some of the additional requirements that were in here, in our view, were a reflection of what we saw some of the better audit committee reports, quite frankly, looking like, but just weren't in today's requirements. So in any event, but your point of making sure we're looking to see what's happening is a very important one. Bob, you'll have the first couple of minutes after the break to rebut that, all right? Arnie Hainish?
Thank you, Marty. I'll try not to be too redundant, but again, thank you. I think that over the blast, having been in a financial management role for and interfacing with an audit committees for over almost 25 years, I think communications are clearly much improved from what they were 20, 25 years ago. I think that the check-the-box mentality that I think many of us have talked about, I think Denny, I think, articulated it pretty well there, right there at the end a few minutes ago. I think that what you don't want is to have all of that litany of activity in there and then just going through it page by page or line by line. I think that many of the suggestions that are in here are probably very positive. I think that I agree with... I agree with Mike Cook in the sense that there needs to be a broader perspective on financial reporting, and specifically maybe something around press releases and other business communications. I think that I actually value the input that an auditor provides me as a member of financial management with regard to their assessment of our communication in press releases in particular, and I've over the years have found a variety of approaches taken by auditors, some better and some worse, as to the amount of input they provide. And I think that in an audit committee member it would be helpful to get the auditor's assessment as to the not necessarily the effectiveness, but you know, whether or not those communications, particularly the press releases, are in their view any way, shape, or form misleading. Because I think in the end, some of those press releases can come back to haunt you as a company. And I think it's good to have an independent view. Now, they're not going to audit those press releases. I want to be careful because I don't want to necessarily create a situation where there's more opportunity for fees. But I think that the opportunity here for insight as part of the normal process that they go through, not just to tick and tie numbers, but to give me insights as to their, and give the audit committee insight into the way things are being communicated and articulated, are very important. I also agree that I know we'll be discussing two-way communications later, but it's very important. I don't necessarily agree that they should provide an assessment of effectiveness, but I think the important point is to have that dialogue and also make sure that the audit committee members are sufficiently versed to answer and ask the right questions as part of a two-way dialogue. The world of accounting and financial reporting over the last 25 years has become so much more complex than it was when I started in a financial reporting role. And had been an auditor for a number of years, but many audit committee members do not have the depth of background to even know what questions to ask in an effective way from a communication standpoint. And it's a rare situation, in my view, where you get an audit committee chair that has a depth of background to even raise those appropriate questions with the auditor to the extent that they need to. I've seen a variety of audit committee chairs over the years, and most don't have the effective background. Even many do, but most do not, to even ask and engage in an effective communication on the topics that are so critical today. And from an investor perspective, I would want my audit committee chairs, as well as those individuals designated as financial experts, to be truly financial experts, and understand the complexities that we at management are having to deal with today in order to perform their fiduciary role responsibly. And I just don't see that consistently across the board. And I'm not sure that that is part of what we're trying to do here, and I don't know how we get that into the spirit, but it's certainly not part of the standard. I think that the idea that the auditors would comment on the quality of financial management, and I think that's been discussed by several individuals, is really critical. I would welcome, as a member of financial management, an in-depth review of by the auditors with my audit committee of the quality not only of myself but also of the staff and the depth of my staff, and I don't see that happening well and sufficiently. I don't see it happen often enough, and it's not just a matter of a discussion around, well, how many people do you have certified or how many internal auditors or CIAs. It's really a question of having an appropriate dialogue around their experience level and the depth of knowledge, because as again, and the fiduciary responsibility is part of this three-legged stool and triangle, they clearly do have a responsibility to provide an independent assessment. And as an audit committee member, I would hope that I would be getting that from my auditors, as to the true depth of knowledge and capabilities and experiences, because you could have an internal audit group that has a whole host of individuals that are CPAs or CIAs that very few of whom ever spent a day of their life in public accounting and understand truly what it is to perform an audit. Many large companies use internal audit as a rotational educational activity to enhance the skills, but how many of those people have really been educated by CPA firms in the precepts of performing an audit and what to look for? And again, going back to even my own staff or staffs of people that are working under controllers, how many of those individuals have really deep knowledge, 8, 10, 12 years of public accounting experience? There's a whole host world of difference between somebody who passed the CPA exam, only had a couple of years of public accounting experience, versus someone who truly does have the depth. And I just don't see those questions being asked of the auditors, and I don't see the auditors really coming forward with those types of those comments. The other aspect is really more around, and I think it's a responsibility of management, but if management doesn't do it, I think the auditor has to step in, and that's the aspect of education of the audit committee members. If management doesn't do it adequately, then the auditors have a responsibility to step in and educate audit committee. Again, it gets back to the earlier comment that I was making around, in order to have an effective two-way dialogue, you really do need to truly have audit committee members that understand what questions that need to be asked. So, thanks for the opportunity, Marty.
Thanks, Arnie. Bob Doerr?
Well, thank you, Marty, and I'll recognizing the time, I'll keep my comments brief, but just to pick up perhaps from the perspective of an auditor a little bit of what Denny and Lynn and others have referred to, and that is the over-communication, if you will, and just caution the board, I've heard some discussion around in lieu of requirements, perhaps a more principles-based approach would be appropriate as to what information should be communicated in the proposed standard. The caution I guess I have there is knowing the animal that we auditors are, when there's a principle that's indicated, normally there's a hue and a cry for some sort of guidance to go along with how you implement that principle. Often that results in a rather lengthy list of items that you would consider communicating, and oftentimes the way the auditor may react to that is that becomes the checklist, because particularly with this subject matter, the auditor would certainly be very concerned with not communicating something that perhaps in hindsight could have been communicated, and they simply made an evaluation and a consideration that they didn't need to communicate it. So I think that list of considers potentially turns into the checklist, which results in the expansive written type of stuff and bearing the real important matters that need to be surfaced. So I guess in summary, like we've heard, tone at the top, quality of financial management. If the consensus is that that's important information that should be communicated in substantially all cases, then let's call it that and make it a requirement. But be very careful about how we use principles, unless the principle is that the auditor should be prepared to communicate anything else that the audit committee may ask. But when we start down the list of what that might be, in essence, we've turned it into a checklist and a requirement that will lead to boilerplate and over-communication.
Thanks, Bob. Kiko, Harvey?
Thank you for the opportunity to join in this roundtable. I think that clearly this has been a daunting task for the PCAOB to write this, because in a lot of ways you're trying to regulate a relationship, and I think that's a very difficult thing to do, to get the right information in the documents, and so I commend you for your efforts. I have heard a lot about tone at the top. I want to remind people, I think, of course, that's an important discussion for audit committee members to be concerned about. From an internal auditor's perspective, we probably are in one of the best roles, along with the external auditors, to provide our views on tone at the top, being that we're in most of the management meetings on a day-to-day basis. We see the communications that go out at the company level, and so basically we see it all. And so, you know, if you're not reaching out to your internal audit teams to ask those questions, and you're relying solely on the external audit group, you're probably just getting part of the picture. So, you know, an important thing to mention. Regarding the quality of financial management, I agree that that's something that the audit committees should be very concerned about. I think that all in all, for most large public accounting or most large public companies, the quality management is very good. I also want to, you know, open the dialogue for the quality of the internal audit team. I think it's very important that is also considered, and I think that the external auditors are probably in a unique position to be able to provide even more insight into whether the internal audit team is really doing their job correctly, whether they have sufficiency of resources, whether they're actually focused in the right areas. And so I think I would welcome that kind of feedback from the external audit teams as well, and I know that we do receive it in the companies that I've worked for. So I'll save my comments for later on. I know we're up against a break, but I thought I'd share that with you.
I appreciate your comments. House Schroeder?
Just one quick follow-on. Marty, you had mentioned that in your current standards you require an assessment of tone at the top, and I have to tell you, I'm in the investment world, and we go both long and short stocks, and some of our best short ideas have been our own assessment of tone at the top. So in a perverse way, I'm glad things aren't working out so well in terms of assessment. I say that half jokingly, but truly some of our best ideas are looking at the interaction between the CEO and the CFO. And I have to question, if I can see this and I only have maybe meet with a CEO or CFO four or five times a year, see them at a couple conferences, if I can see it, how did the auditors and how did the audit committee not see it? So something really needs to be addressed here. And we've said it over and over again, but that was probably the quickest way to get to the point that I'm making money off of people not doing their jobs in terms of assessing tone at the top. So maybe I'll retire after this, but...
Well, I have to break the rules here. Those were the cards that were up, and I saw one card came up late, but to show you the flexibility of the organization, Sam.
Well, I appreciate that, Marty, and I will be very brief and not discuss any topic we're going to discuss later. As I sat through this and as I prepared for this, I thought this first section was a place as an auditor. It'd be really important for me to hear what others want. And so as an auditor, I think that I can stress that the relationship between the auditor and the audit committee is a significant relationship and plays into our ability as auditors to appropriately dispense of our professional responsibilities. And as a result of the importance of that relationship, I think as an auditor, I have my own views about, you know, maybe someday I'll be on an audit committee and what I think is important. But I think at the end of the day, auditors want to provide information to audit committees that will help them dispense their responsibilities. And I don't know where that is, other than my own views, but I do think there is a pretty good rhythm today between audit committees and auditors with respect to communication. Could that be enhanced? Probably. But I think your standards got to leave some flexibility with respect to with respect to the various requirements. With respect to comments around writing standards to the lowest common denominator, I mean, I don't think I can emphasize enough how you cannot write standards to the lowest common denominator and expect a high-functioning financial reporting regime. It just, it simply does not work to write standards. Quite frankly, it doesn't, in most things in life, make sense to go to the lowest common denominator. Ask a teacher, if you're teaching to the lowest common denominator, what that does to the overall class. And I'm not a teacher nor an audit committee member, but that hasn't stopped me yet. The last thing that I will say is, and something to consider, is considering the varied comments around too much, too little. Once you adopt a final standard, whatever way you go, maybe this would be an interesting topic for some field testing post-implementation to see whether or not you've hit it right. I mean, obviously, you got to give it a couple of years to see, but maybe this would be a place where post-implementation would make a lot of sense. Thanks.
Thanks, Sam. And I want to thank everybody for the value of these comments during this very first session. Very, very thoughtful input and very valuable input for us as we go back and consider the standard. We'll take a 15-minute break till about, according to my watch, 5 minutes till 11. And let's try to be back around then. Thank you very much.
All right, welcome back. Marty asked that I start this session, which I had planned to moderate this session anyway, so that works out perfectly. The next topic is accounting policies, practices, and estimates, and this is an area where we had also received significant comments from commenters. And your briefing paper includes an appendix, Appendix A, listing paragraphs 12 and 13 from the proposed standard. And those two paragraphs have several requirements regarding accounting policies, practices, and estimates. So that's our focus of the discussion right now. Steve Harris, a PCAB board member, will provide some introductory remarks, and then I'll walk through the questions.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and I'll be very brief. As you point out, for the next 30 minutes, we'd like to hear the group's views on what you think should be the specific responsibility of the auditors to provide timely observations to the audit committee about accounting policies, practices, and estimates. We're particularly pleased that leading the discussion will be Mike Cook and Hal Schroeder. While the proposed standard retains and clarifies many of the existing requirements in the current standard, it also updates the standard by incorporating existing SEC communication requirements. Several commentators have stated that the proposed required communications, we've heard it this morning, strike the right balance and include important critical issues on which audit committees need to focus. Others, however, and we've heard that this morning as well, feel that the proposed standard may be too onerous for audit committees, with the volume of required communications potentially taking time away from more important issues. There were also concerns expressed that the requirements overlap with management's communication responsibilities. During the discussion today, we are seeking your input, and as specifically as possible, on whether the board should modify the proposed requirements. And in that regard, we are interested in understanding which additional matters the standard should require the auditor to communicate, if any, or perhaps which proposed or currently required communications should be eliminated. So, Jennifer, thank you very much, and I understand you'll start the session off with a couple of specific questions.
Thank you, Steve. We had three questions in the briefing paper, so I'll put those up on the slide. The first one was, how could the communication requirements be modified so that the auditor and the audit committee focus on the most significant accounting issues and estimates? The next one, how could the proposed standard clarify the types of consultations that should be communicated to the audit committee? And then finally, are there matters in addition to those in Appendix A, which are paragraphs 12 and 13 of the standard, that the proposed standard should require auditors to communicate? And if so, what are those matters and why should they be required? If there are any requirements that should be omitted, what are those and why should they be omitted? So we're not flipping back in between these two slides as we're going through the discussion. We have a discussion summary slide highlighting those three points on here. We have asked a couple people, Mike Cook and Hal Schroeder, to provide some of their thoughts on these questions to help open up the discussion. Before I turn it over to Mike, I would like, as Marty had pointed out in the earlier session, many had commented on that perhaps some of the requirements in the proposed standard were too onerous. Most of those comments like that were directed at these specific requirements, and also commenters indicated that management often is communicating these many of these same points regarding accounting policies, practices, and estimates, so why it doesn't make sense for the auditor to duplicate all of that and waste the audit committee's time. When we had drafted the standard, we recognized, as the board's current standard does, that management often does communicate these type of matters to the audit committee. And we had we think it's a fix we can make through a drafting point, but many commenters seem to not pick up what we had intended, which was for the auditor to evaluate what management has communicated, and if the auditor believes management has appropriately communicated many of these items, they wouldn't need to repeat it. It's only in those instances if the auditor believes management hasn't done an adequate job of communicating some of these items. So just wanted to point that out. Many commenters expressed that concern, and we are aware of that. So with that said, I'd like to open up the discussion and first turn to Mike Cook and then Hal Schroeder to provide some your thoughts on these questions.
Jennifer, I'll try not to repeat some of the things I said earlier because some of the trains of thought are consistent. I always remember one of my partners said, if you can't be right, be consistent. So I'm probably not right on some of these topics, but I still have the same point of view. A couple of the key questions about, you know, the issues of what could we add, are present requirements sufficient, and so on. I have a view that the present requirements are, in fact, sufficient. It troubles me a bit that we are adding, as we describe on page three, these newer requirements for the auditor if management hasn't done its communication job correctly. That doesn't sit right with me, and somebody said you've got the emphasis on the wrong syllable here. I mean, we are telling management what management needs to be communicating, even though we have no authority to dictate communication practices to management, but we're doing that because we're saying if you don't do it, the auditors are going to be required to do it, and we write rules for auditors. Therefore, we can write the rules that say if these things haven't been done, the auditor will do them. I don't think that's the right thrust, and I appreciate what Marty said earlier, and I would just say please do give careful attention to this question about management's communication responsibilities, and not indirectly by writing rules for auditors. If management fails, write the communication rules for management through this type of communication. If you think that needs to be done, there ought to be a forum to do it, but not backdooring it through the audit communication process, in my judgment, is not the right way to go about it. Likewise, I think there are some things that could be done with the focus on the audit, and I continue to believe we need a broader focus on financial reporting, and Lynn and I will debate some parts of that later. But I do think we need that broader view. But focusing on the audit, there is one thing I would like to recommend be given consideration, because Linda and I, and to some extent Denny and others who were on the Committee for the Improvement in Financial Reporting, labored long and hard and agonized over the issue of a framework for auditors to use and management to use in the first instance to make judgments, to make estimates, and auditors to evaluate the estimates and judgments that have been made by management in preparing the financial statements. I think that would be a superb addition to this document, which would be an inquiry or a dialogue between the audit committee and the audit firm about how the audit firm, it could be the firm as a whole, it could be specific to the engagement or to a particular accounting or auditing matter, how does the firm make the judgments? What is the framework for the judgments that are made on the critical issues in the financial statements? Seems to me that fits here and would be a nice addition to this dialogue that is not, it's probably suggested in a number of places, but it's not addressed directly. Present requirements in most areas, I think, are quite sufficient. This doesn't pertain to estimates and judgments, but I would hope maybe, I realize some of the things we have are here because of the requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley. They're part of the law, therefore the audit committee gets them whether the audit committee wants them or not. But it would be refreshing if we could find a way to, in consultation and discussion with audit committees, to take away some of the things we don't want, don't need, and don't know what to do with when we get it, and Denny's reference to the representation letters, if we could get a one-paragraph summary of the things that are new and different in some of these documents rather than receiving full-text documents, and maybe we have that flexibility and we're not using it. But we sure get a lot of things that I ask, and I think I have a reasonable basis for knowing what to expect. I ask, why am I getting this? And the answer is because I'm required to give it to you. And you're required to take it if I'm required to give it to you, even if you don't want it and don't know what to do with it. To the point that Hal made earlier about the notion about audit committees, there are audit committee chairmen who know, in addition to what to emphasize, to what to ignore. But there are a lot of people who don't have that same training and background who, when they get a 40-page representation letter four times a year, presume that there must be something there that they really need to know something about, and then are encumbered with the burden of reading it and trying to understand it. And it would be so much better if those communications could be streamlined, focused on things that are new and different, which goes to the point of how do you focus on the things that are most important? Don't burden people with things that are not most important, or do it in such a way that it is highly efficient and best practices can hopefully convey some of that information. So I'd like to see us get rid of some of the existing practices. I would very much like to see us focus on the judgment framework being a part of the communication process between the audit committee and the audit firm, because it is related to the audit and the process that is followed in doing the audit. With respect to this question about consultation, I think it's a very good thing. I think the idea of if there are important issues that the firm has engaged others, whether they're industry specialists, senior partners in the firm, where the engagement team has brought others to bear on reaching important judgments and important conclusions. I think that's a very valid thing for an audit committee to have an interest in the dialogue. Trying to define it, and defining it in some ways with references to things like informal conversations, I really don't think, particularly if the notion might evolve that it would have to be a written communication subject to 14 review processes, I really don't think I want to be on the receiving end of a communication when the lead partner decides to call somebody that they happen to know in another office to get an insight on a industry issue or something of that kind. I would again urge that we write the principle of what we're trying to achieve. We are trying to achieve a high level, a better level of knowledge, transparency at the audit committee on important issues that the firm has wrestled with and presumably management has wrestled with as well. Write the principle and let the firm decide what it is that should be communicated to the audit committee that meets that requirement. And not try to write if it takes more than 15 minutes, if there are more than three people involved, if it is somebody who's more than 100 miles away, or however else we might define this consultation. Leave that out and let the firm decide what is important to communicate to the audit committee. And then in the interest of trying to think of something that I would like to suggest we don't need, there is something, I think it's in back on page 13, which struck my fancy in this new thing that we're going to communicate under accounting estimates. If the auditor determines that potential bias exists in management's accounting estimates, to begin with, I probably don't think the auditor needs to be making that determination, but I have never seen an accounting estimate for which there is not potential for bias. I mean, that is the inherent nature of accounting estimates, that potential exists, and it's that kind of a rule or that kind of an auditor determination requirement that leads to a great deal of consternation, effort, cost, and little of value. If management is consistently making judgments with a bias which produces an overall bias in the financial statements, and you feel that needs to be communicated to the audit committee, I could understand that and support it. Every estimate that is made that has a potential for bias is every estimate that is made, and I wouldn't suggest that would be a step forward. Overall, I mean, I think most of what we have today is good, works well. I'm concerned as an audit committee member of the backdooring management communication requirements and the specificity that this gives to what an audit committee is going to receive that an audit committee may not have decided it needs in a particular situation, and transferring that responsibility to the standard-setting process, I think, is going a little further than we should. That's it.
Thanks, Mike. And I had the same observation. I thought all biases are... There's a bias in every single estimate. So, unlike a lot of you around this table, I don't spend 100% of my time thinking about accounting and auditing issues. I spend maybe 2% of my time. And so I apologize in advance, but I'm going to give you kind of my perspective on this. As I read Appendix A, there were three things that really struck me. The first was the volume of information. It was just overwhelming, and it seemed to be extremely technical. The ability of the average audit committee member, I think it's going to be beyond the average audit committee member to understand the implications of what's being said. I know how much I struggle today with accounting issues in trying to understand the intricacies and how they affect accounting estimates and other things. But the thing that really struck me most about this three-page excerpt was that the use of the word significant and critical. In a three-page document, it was used, those two words were used to combine 24 times. If you're counting, it was 10 significant and 14 critical. So I started to think about, what do those words really, really mean? And I had trouble answering it because I couldn't get over the first part of the question. The first part is, significant and critical to who? Is it to the auditor? Is it to the audit committee? Is it the board? Is it the management of the firm? Or is it the investor? And I stumbled on the word investor. because is it a fixed income investor? Is it an equity investor? If it's an equity investor, is a long only equity investor, or is it a long short equity investor? And you can go on and on and on. There are multiple layers. What it reminded me of is a speech I gave to my old firm, Ernst & Young. I'd spent 13 years there in both practice and national office. And then a few years later, I was a sell-side analyst on Wall Street, and they asked me to come back and basically give a speech somewhere along the lines of, what have you learned that you wish you knew when you were an auditor? And I thought about it for a second, and I actually drew a little graphic here on my paper to help me remember what I thought about, but it really came down to communication. What I did not appreciate at the time I was auditing was the level of communication that was outside the company. So you've got not only the auditors talking to the audit committee and management, but you also have functions within management, particularly investor relations, talking to the investor community, talking to fixed income, talking to equity investors, understanding what their issues are. And it really came home to me last week when I listened to a presentation last week by a very well-known CEO last Tuesday. And he said he came back from vacation, he sat down with the investor relations group and had them put down on a piece of paper what were the critical issues that investors were asking about, this whole wide range of different types of investors. He says, I want to address each one of those today. And in doing that, what he did in literally about 15 minutes was knock off every single critical issue that the large investor base was thinking about. And the advantage of it to the company is that investors don't all think alike, but they come at each company with a wide range of perspectives. They talk to probably more people at a higher level than a lot of audit firms do. I know when I was auditor, if I got to talk to the CFO or the CEO, that was a really, really big deal. I was usually dealing much lower in the organization. As an investor, if I'm not talking to the CEO or CFO, I'm talking to a head of a line of business. Very, very different perspectives, and the communication is very, very different. So the questions that I'm asking them, that the investor relations people who are diligently recording, give you a tremendous perspective on what I think is significant and critical, what will move the stock the next day when they say something. So what I did was I called around, or had some of my team call around to a couple of large banks that I follow and asked them, how do you communicate information questions that we have? And some of them had some very clear routines of not only the CFO and the CEO, but also the board and the audit committee in particular. Other companies had no real routine, so as I looked at this, I would focus on things like significant and critical. Who is it significant and critical to? And how could that massive list of what we think as investors is significant and critical, how could that be effectively communicated not only through management, the board, and the audit committee, but also to the investor, or excuse me, to the audit firms. Again, it comes back to that. I wish I had known certain things when I was auditing. It would give me a lot better sense of what truly was significant and critical.
Thanks, Hal, and thanks, Mike. One thing I just did want to point out, it probably wouldn't be beyond me, Mike, to try to backdoor something into this, but the board wouldn't let me do that. These issues in paragraph 12 were things that we think should be communicated by the auditor to the audit committee. It's just we're reflecting our knowledge of practice, and that is that in many cases management does make these communications, so rather than duplication, we indicated if management makes them, the auditor evaluates them. But we really weren't trying to require a management communication. They were things, at least from our perspective in writing the standard, we thought the auditor should communicate. So that was the purpose there. With that, is that your card, Charlie?
No, it's Danny.
Oh, Danny.